thank you, Barbara and Joe and great panelists for this last session that takes the round view of the League of Arab States and the broader macro issues, but brings them down, as John Moran did, to very micro levels of realistic expectations and aspirations for people's dreams and longings and ideals. I want to make just 5 points in terms of concluding here. First one is that a conference like this is not planned over a weekend, and it has a lot of input and comment, suggestions, and productive commentary from its supporters to try to improve it from one year to the next, to keep the things that have worked well, jettison those that haven't worked so well, introduce new ones, try to make it as relevant and timely and urgent and focused in terms of the mutuality of challenges as well as mutuality of benefits, and the reciprocity of respect as well as the reciprocity of rewards. It cannot be a one-way street on any side, as we seek in various capacities to enhance strategic advantage and also to acquire economic gains. Despite the inspirational aspects of the Arab events of the last 10 years, the reality comes down to the crushing material well-being, standards of living, cost of living, questions of dignity and humility and self-respect, and truth and accountability and transparency and responsibility, not only from one's own leaders, from which one has a right to expect basic dignity and human respect, but a right to demand basic respect and human rights and the administration of same. So we have a superb board of directors that provides strategic guidance and vision, and we have a management and staff and interns and volunteers that have all put their shoulders together to make this happen, along with their corporate embassy, U.S. government agencies, and foundational representatives who've provided the wherewithal to make this possible. And though it's late in the day and some of them are still outside in the atrium, et cetera, I would like for those who fit that 4 or 5 part category of people who helped to make this possible, if they would please stand and take a round of applause. Most of them are in the back of the room, and that's metaphorically perhaps appropriate because they're back behind the scenes and making things happen that seem to be so effortless and work out seamlessly. And from an executive point of view, we're not a large organization. We have a total of 8 staff, and it's my decision that half the staff can have all the day off on Monday, and the other half can have all the day off on Tuesday. We don't want the office to be left unattended for people who might call in for requests or assistance or criticisms or maybe a compliment here or there. And while so much of the focus has been on tangible issues regarding defense and regarding material well-being and economics and finance and developments and gross national products, product and employment and jobs and the like, there is running through this entire region, and it's overlapping with other ones, things that are far less tangible. There. Emotional for many people, in some cases, political or ideological, and fit in with their moral principles and ethical precepts. And I would string the following together as the frames of reference in that regard. For fully half of humanity, those of the monotheistic faiths of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, this is the birthplace of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Geographically, it is also the crossroads of three continents, Africa, Europe, and Asia. Historically, it's also the cradle of culture and the cradle of civilization as Westerners know it and have been rooted in it. And these count for a significant part as well of the emotional draw and appeal and staying power of the region. It is also the anvil of antiquity, as we know this in the Western world, and the source of sunshine on the classical world. And in terms of the three monotheistic faiths, it sometimes comes down to what seems to be the traffic jam of the devout in terms of the issues of sectarianism and people trying to establish protection to defend their right to live their faith and have it respected. With regard to the phrase that was mentioned earlier, some 40 to 50 million American Christian Zionists, one might ask oneself the following in terms of the connects or the disconnects in terms of these 40 to 50 million, and that's the lowest figure I have seen, with regard to the practicing of the golden rule of do not do unto others that which you would not have others do unto you. How well are we scoring on that particular reference point, that marker, that standard of achievement and behavior? And if one takes just the Ten Commandments there, how well do these 40 to 50 million and others fare with regard to one of the commandments of honor their father and mother in terms of Iraqi and Palestinian and Syrian and Yemeni, Tunisian and Egyptian mothers and fathers in terms of U.S. policies, active or proactive or absence, or do not bear false witness against one's neighbor in terms of the trait of deception and deceit and duplicity and complicity and lies and falsehoods and misrepresentations and misinformation about what this region and its peoples and its longings are all about. And what about thou shalt not murder or thou shalt not kill in terms of the references of more than 4,000 Americans killed in Iraq? But we know that there are hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who've been killed at the same time that those Americans have been killed. Most Americans know that there are 58,000 names on a wall in the Vietnam Memorial here in Washington who died in Vietnam. But how many Americans know that more than 1.3 million Vietnamese were killed at the same time that those 58,000 were killed? And in terms of not making unto thyself a graven image, which is perhaps grown up out of town language for being full of hubris or kind of narcissism or first person singular egotism run amok, how well do we fare on those five commandments? Or a sixth one, thou shalt not steal. We had His Royal Highness Prince Turkey stand here with a copy of the U.S. Constitution in his hand. And he quoted, of course, from the words penned by Jefferson. But I'm one among many, and so is Dr. Hussein Hassouna, who got the largest number of votes in the last few years to codify international law at the Commission in Geneva, who appreciates Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, which posits as follows, that those conventions, international treaties and laws to which the United States is a sovereign signatory are to be reckoned as the supreme law of the land. In other words, superior to federally enacted legislation. And we are a member of the United Nations by treaty. And in the Charter of the United Nations is prohibited the acquisition of territory by force. How well do we fare in terms of that particular moral standard having to do with peace and justice in this particular region? And we have the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949, passed in the atmosphere of the Nuremberg trials, in the recent ravages of Europe, in the ashes and embers of the Holocaust there, in terms of what the Fourth Geneva Convention prohibits. And it prohibits the occupying powers from expropriating the occupied people's lands and territories. It prohibits the occupying power from exploiting the natural resources of water and trees and vineyards and orchards of the occupied peoples. It prohibits the occupying power from expelling the occupied peoples from their territories. It prohibits the occupying power from settling its people in the territories of the occupied peoples. How well do we stand on that when we have an administration, this time led, as others have been, with a legal background in terms of constitutional law and applying the rule of law ourselves, in addition to admonishing others for not doing likewise? What we've had here in these kinds of discussions, I think, has brought about a reflection of a greater sense of usness than has existed in previous years, where most Americans would look at this region as a collectivity of gas stations, not as countries, or as mountains of money, rather than as the bearers and the legacies and the generators and the progenitors of the values and the ideals and many of the moral and ethical principles that we hold dear here. And how far we've gone also from not looking at the region just as a collectivity of objects to be manipulated, influenced, controlled, dominated, brought over to and kept upon our side, but to see them also in terms of actors with their own legitimate needs, their own legitimate concerns, their own legitimate interests, their own legitimate foreign policy objectives. When I made reference earlier today to the American domestic spring, just about 100 feet outside the doors here, and we see that the world is indeed quite a bit closer, and that it's not just social media, it's technology that can get the word out that enough is enough is enough. You see the occupations of Wall Street districts. You see the same tactics and techniques being used in Ohio and states like Wisconsin. And I'm predicting that there'll be quite a bit more to come of all of that. And so what we've had here is a diversity of viewpoint. We've had an identicality of viewpoints amongst many different speakers. There's been some overlap, some duplication, and that's inevitable because we didn't rehearse all of this. But in terms of the richness, I would offer the following as a closing note here, that neither all the presenters nor all of us listeners and active participants and attendees, we have no monopoly on the method. We have no copyright on the concept. We have no patent on the process. We have no trademark on the technique. I think we're all the better for taking this as seriously as we have. Thank you.